among the things that we really need to be praying for is space. The last frontier. No. We are continuing to move forward with the plans for the beautiful property up on the hill. Had the three-hour meeting. Pastor Ross was there with engineers and other smart people. And even in the best scenario, it's still going to be a year and a half, 2 years before we actually have a facility to move into. But growth here is going to be stifled unless God works a miracle. I think really we need to be praying. Could be wrong, but I think God wants to do something unique that we may not be planning on, that we can't even devise, and He'll just get the glory when it happens. But I think this this group and this work really needs some breathing room, and we need to just pray that God will show us what to do next. So I hope you'll join me in praying about the space issue. It's a good problem to have, but it is a problem. And so I trust that God will give us an answer. By the way, it's not my work, it's His work. It's not Pastor Ross's work, this is His work. And so we're praying that God will bless His work and help us know how to move forward. I think He will. I remember once the disciples came to, sons of the prophet, came to Elisha, and they said, the place where we are is too narrow. They said, we need to build something. And he blessed, didn't he? And he worked something out for them. They built a place there by the Jordan. I'd like to talk to you today, kind of a serious subject, soldiers and suicide missions. One of the things that made me think about this as a subject was an incident in history, dating from the time of Alexander the Great, when he was going across Asia, conquered much of it, and the areas of Persia, was entering India. His soldiers were extremely dedicated, disciplined, had a lot of experience. You already know the legends about how devoted and sacrificial the Spartan soldiers were. Well, the Macedonians were equally dedicated. And Alexander inspired them because he would go into battle with them. He would charge right out in front of them. They had to pull him back a few times because they thought, what's going to happen if he dies? He'd go storming over a wall, trying to take a city right with his soldiers. And once he was seriously wounded and barely recovered. And so they had tremendous devotion and dedicated for Alexander, and they would obey his orders without question. An example of this is once he came to conquer one of the cities in India, which was about the outer region of where his forces went. And this big walled city was filled with soldiers, and the king got up on the wall. Alexander approached. It was a hilly country. And Alexander went down into the valley and he approached, and through a translator, he shouted up to the king on the wall, I demand that you and all in your city surrender and you'll live. And the king put his hands on his hip, and up from the wall, he laughed down at Alexander. He says, you have a lot of audacity to ask us to surrender. He says, we're well fortified. We've got food. We've got water. We have more soldiers than you have. What do you mean surrender? And Alexander called to his soldiers that were up on a bluff opposite the city, and there was a very steep cliff that went down over 100 feet. He told a group of 100 soldiers to line up in single file, and then he gave them the order to march forward towards the cliff. And they marched without hesitation towards the cliff, and the first one went over, tumbled down to his death, the second one, the third one, and they continued to just march straight off the cliff. When they got to 11, he called halt, and they stopped. He turned back to the king, and he said, now, you need to surrender. And the king consulted with his soldiers in the city, and they decided to open the gates and surrender. The reason being, they knew that those Macedonian soldiers were so dedicated that if they were willing to obey their commander to the point of, without flinching, to lay down their lives, that they were going to throw everything they had at that city until they were either all gone or the city was taken. And they knew they did not have that kind of resolve. Now, you can find a number of stories in the Bible of sacrificial soldiers. Some good, some bad, but sacrificial nonetheless. You know, one that comes to mind is in the book of Exodus chapter 12. You know, we think about the story of the Pharaoh when his soldiers were chasing the children of Israel into the Red Sea. That would have been a tough order to follow, right? You can find that in Exodus 12. You go to verse 33. During the plagues that came on Egypt, you know, at first, the first plague came, and the, you know, counselors of the Pharaoh, they said, oh, this is coincidence. Water turning to blood, it must be some kind of red algae. I don't know what they said. They said, by the way, our magicians can do this. Moses doing, he's doing it through magic. We haven't got it figured out, but we can do it through magic, just not a whole river. And then the second plague they matched, and the third plague they matched, and they thought it might have been just, you know, plagues that come through natural occurrence. But as they began to compound, and it got worse and worse pretty soon, they said, this is the finger of God. When the lice came, the magicians of the Pharaoh couldn't duplicate the lice. They said, this is the finger of God. We haven't got anything that we can buy off the magic store that looks like lice. And eventually, they said, you can read here in Exodus 12, verse 33, the Egyptians urged the people to send them out of the land in haste, for they said, we shall all be dead. They said, they need to go, and they need to go fast, because, of course, after the Passover, all the firstborn died. Now, I just want you to have a picture of the state of mind of what has happened. They said to the Pharaoh, send them away. Don't you know that Egypt is destroyed? They had been destroyed economically. They had been decimated in their population. Their livestock had been destroyed, and they had hardly anything left. And then the children of Israel, they began their exodus. The Egyptians gave them all this gold and silver and said, just take it, go. And loaded them down, and they took all their wagons and their people, and they started heading out towards the Red Sea. And you know the story. They came to the borders of the Red Sea. It was a southern part. There were actually mountains flanking both sides. You can read about this in the book Patriarchs and Prophets as well. And as the Egyptians, Pharaoh, you know, just so overwhelmed with pride and regret that he was losing, he mustered what was left of his forces. He said, we're letting all our slaves get away. What came over us? Let's go get them back. And they obeyed, and they got in their chariots, and they got on their horses. They started charging towards the Israelites. Well, that night, they couldn't attack because all of a sudden there was this supernatural vortex, like a tornado, a pillar of cloud that stood between them, glowing on the Israeli side and darkness on the Egyptian side. Well, that would have been an ominous sign to me. I would have said, look, let's go home. Pharaoh was stubborn. That is the biggest understatement of the message. Pharaoh was really stubborn, hard-hearted. Pride does that to you, makes you dumb. The devil knows he's going to lose, but he doesn't stop. Says he's come down with great wrath because he knows his time is short. Next morning, the pillar of cloud is gone. The Egyptians wake up and they see there are walls of water standing up on the right and the left where water naturally should like flow together. And they could see the trail of the children of Israel that they had been going across the sea through the night. And this is just these waving walls of water, probably a couple hundred feet high. And I would have said, well, obviously God is with them. I mean, here he's just parted the sea, and there it is. It's still split, water standing up like a wall. We better turn back and say, hey, we tried. But what does Pharaoh do? He says to all of his soldiers, forward. Now, who would want to be a soldier in the Pharaoh's army that day? But what did they do? They obeyed. That, to me, is one of the big pieces of the story you never hear. The soldiers of the Pharaoh, there's no record that they had a committee meeting to talk about it, but without question, they obeyed. What kind of soldiers are we for our king? If he were to send us on what we might think is a suicide mission, would we want to counsel the Lord to reconsider, or would we obey? What kind of soldier should we be? You know, I thought about putting in the verses in the Bible that talk about the armor of God in Ephesians chapter 6, and I thought, no, that's not going to fit. You know why? We all like that message about the armor of God because the armor is there to help us survive the battle. What I'm talking about is, would you obey if you're not going to survive the battle? Would you march off into the face of death, sacrificial, saying, I'm going to take up my cross and I'm going to be crucified with Christ. I'm going to die and still obey. Might I submit to you that that is the kind of faith that we need in the last days? We need the kind of faith that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had when they said, we'd rather die than disobey our God. Or the faith that Daniel had when he said, I'd rather go to the lion's den and die than disobey my God. That's the kind of faith I want. You know, there's some other stories in the Bible that really amaze me. By the way, another verse I'd like to point you to is 2 Timothy 2, verse 3 and 4. 2 Timothy 2, 3 and 4. You, therefore, must endure hardship as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. No one engaged in warfare entangles himself with the affairs of this life that he might please him who enlisted him as a soldier. Now, son Daniel was in the Marines, thought it was really funny. Sometimes young people join the Marines so they can get away if their mom and dad telling them what to do. They think they're going to join the military and find freedom. That's not why Daniel did it. But daughter Cherie was in the army. Her husband was in the army. He went to Afghanistan. Daniel went to Iraq. And something that I've heard about that is not uncommon, you know, there's a lot of women in the military now. And they join the military ostensibly to serve the country. And why in the military? They have a baby. Yeah, they've got no rules against that. Or they haven't found it's effective. But then they have this brand new baby and their orders come through and they're told, you must deploy. Now it's hard enough for a soldier, a man, to leave his family or even just his homeland and go to some foreign country. Sometimes they think it's exciting. But you tell a new mother, you need to strap on your gear, hand your baby over to somebody else that you've just had, and you've got to go and risk your life. Boy, they really have problems with that. And I heard some stories from the family of some very creative scenarios they create to avoid deploying and avoid jail. But when you're a soldier, there's a lot of young women who have babies that are, sometimes they've got two. They got a child and then they have a brand new baby and their orders come through. We've trained you for this function. We need you overseas. And you have to leave your children, and they do. Boy, that's tough. What kind of soldiers are we? You know, I think about Uriah in the Bible, Uriah the Hittite. When we hear about Uriah, we automatically gravitate to the more sordid part of the story with David and Bathsheba. But really, for me, one of the most phenomenal parts of the story is the dedication of Uriah. Here you've got this soldier that is so committed to obeying his general and to the battle and the army of God that when he comes home, he's been stationed out in the field. They've been bivouacked out in the field fighting against the Ammonites, eating army rations back then. They didn't even have can openers. They didn't have cans. Must have been pretty bleak. And they're out there in the field for months. Actually, when you besiege a city, it could take years. He's allowed to come home. The king asks for a report on the battle. Uriah's probably wondering why they couldn't have sent a person of lower rank, but he answers. He then gives him a basket of food. What are those bouquets, Karen, where they call them something edibles, Sherry's edibles, or credible edibles? These fruit bouquets, you know what I'm talking about? Yeah, he sends him with a fruit bouquet and says, you go on home, say hi to Bathsheba for me. And just relax. What does he do? He shares the bouquet with the other guards at the gate. And he says, I'm going to sleep with the soldiers in the king's house. I have no right to go home because I'm still involved in warfare. And what kind of respect will my soldiers have for me if I come home and brag about my R&R when they've been on the front lines? And David can't get him to go home because all Uriah can think about is the battle. Men are derided a lot because we are task-oriented. And I don't think there's too many women here that would understand her husband being 100 yards away and not coming home. Did Uriah do the right thing or the wrong thing? Ha, nobody's going to weigh in on that, especially if you're here with your spouse, right? Well, moving right along. Uriah was task-oriented. And by the way, I think God made men task-oriented to some extent. And women can be too, and men can be relationship-oriented, but he was very focused on the battle. And he left from the palace without stopping home, and he went directly back to the front lines until the battle was won. But he didn't know he was taking his death warrant. David had written out and sealed some orders he handed to Uriah. Boy, how despicable can you be? One of your mighty men, loyal soldier. And it said to Joab, take Uriah and set him at the front of the hottest battle and retire from him that he is smitten and dies. So Joab gets his orders, he reads them, he looks at Uriah, he studies the orders again, and who knows what went through his mind. But he was a good soldier, and he understood war, and he knew that the city of the Ammonites, it was Rabbah, the capital city, well fortified up in the hills, on the eastern side of the Jordan River. And he knew there was this one place where there was a contingent of very strong, effective, valiant soldiers, Ammonite soldiers, and they were well armed. And he gave this crazy order to Uriah. He said, I want you to charge the gates here at this section of the city. And Uriah looks at him like, how long have we fought together? None of my men are going to survive that. That's a suicide mission. They'll just shoot down from the wall. They'll throw rocks at us. They'll pour boiling oil over the wall and set us on fire. We can't survive that. Oh, we'll cover you. We've got your back. Remember what David said? And retire from him that he is smitten. And I think that Uriah knew that this was a suicide mission, but there's nothing in the Bible that records that he hesitated. He charged off up against the gates. Matter of fact, the report is given in the Bible. You can read in 2 Samuel 11, Joab, when he's sending a report to David that Uriah is killed and some of the other men were killed in the process. And he knows that David is going to say, what kind of a crazy maneuver was that, that you charged the wall? Who struck down Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal? Did not a woman throw an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died at Thebes? Why did you go so near the wall? Is it clear that it was a suicide mission? And so Joab is going to tell the servant, don't forget to mention Uriah is dead and David will not criticize this crazy suicide order. So you can tell from the context, even Joab expected David to be outraged at the plan. But he said, that's what I had to do. I know you lost some men, but you ordered me to get rid of Uriah, and they're dead. Well, that tells me that those soldiers went without question and obeyed. That's tough. Hardest thing for me. I've never been in the military except military school. But two military schools by the time, first one 5, second one from 11 to 13, you get it out of your system. The hardest thing in the world for me was trying to understand, but it was very valuable. I got in so much trouble at school because I would always argue with my teachers because I thought, I know better than you. Are you doing this the wrong way? I got a better idea. And I thought everything I was asked to do was open to discussion. And what I learned in military school is you obey orders, you don't discuss them. And the hardest thing is when you had what you thought was an ignoramus who had more rank than you, telling you to do the wrong thing the wrong way, and you had to do it. Any of you ever been in the military? Isn't that tough? And you think, this guy has got half my IQ, it's a dumb order, and he doesn't even know how to do a dumb order the right way, but I've got to do what he says. Because he's in charge. Are we going to counsel the Lord when he tells us what to do? Or are we going to obey? He wants us to be sacrificial soldiers. So Uriah went. Jesus said, Matthew 7:21, not everyone that says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter into the kingdom of heaven, but those that do the will of my Father in heaven. Yes, it has something to do with doing his will and obeying what he says. Oswald Chambers said, the meaning of sacrifice is the deliberate giving of the best that I have to God, that he might make it his and mine forever. If I cling to it, I lose it, and so does God. Whenever God gives you some difficult orders and it requires sacrifice, you're holding back from God if you don't do exactly what he says. You know how many miracles God's people have missed out on because we did not obey a difficult order? God would have done something and we'll never know. I remember going to the ruins of Masada, where a handful of Jews, well, there's 900 Jews, but they held off the Roman army for 3 years. And just before the Roman army attacked, and it's very real when you're up there, it's palatable when you're actually at Masada and they tell you the story. And you're looking down, you can see the Romans built this ramp that is still there to this day, a dirt ramp they built to get up there. And then you hear about how they all went through the ritual of every man had to kill his own family, and the last ones killed the killers. I think two women and five children survived, they hid. And I always thought, what would God have done if instead of this suicide pact, if they had said, we're going to pray that God will do something to deliver us marvelously? We'll never know, not this side of heaven. What could have happened? How many times would God have parted the sea for us if we had not retreated or at least put our foot in the water? And we'll never know. I know a lot of people that might have the miracle job right now if they had been willing to keep the Sabbath instead of saying, well, but I got to break the Sabbath until I can get my new, hours or whatever. And God was going to do a miracle for them, but he couldn't do the miracle because they didn't step out in faith. And I think God is waiting to do great things, but he wants us to have unquestioning obedience. I heard one time about during a battle between Leopold, Duke of Austria, and the Swiss Confederacy. This is in 1386. The Swiss were greatly outnumbered by the Austrian forces. As a matter of fact, the Austrian forces were about 3-1. And up on the hill, as they were approaching, they had basically an unbroken flank, like a picket fence, of spears aiming at the Swiss. And the Swiss knew the only way that we're going to have any kind of hope of victory is we've got to break their ranks. But somebody's going to have to basically charge the spears to do it. And this one tall Swiss, Arnold Winkerland, he nobly sacrificed his life. He said to the soldier, he says, follow behind me. And he charged up against the ranks of the Austrians. He grabbed as many spears as he could and pulled them towards himself and ran forward. And he was slain, but he broke the ranks so that the Swiss were able to get through the line of spears and ultimately rout the Austrians. But he had to lay his life down to do it because the battle he felt and his people he felt were more important than his own life. As a Christian, is it about you or is it about God? Is it about his people? Is it about his movement? And yet, what you're hearing among a lot of Christians is the whole service is to be designed around a person's felt needs. We're going to do a survey, and we're going to find out what you all think you might need or what you might want in a church service. What will make you happy? If it's donuts and hot chocolate that make you happy, we'll bring donuts and hot chocolate. If it's something more entertaining, if it's more lively, if it's brighter colors, whatever it is, if you don't want to have to dress up, whatever it is that's going to make you happy, we're going to try and design a service to make you happy because that's what Christianity is all about. Don't we hear that this day? The gospel of Christ is being corrupted into give people what they want instead of it being the soldier mentality. Lord, what do you want? It's not about me. I'm here to obey you. You can also find another similar story in the Bible regarding, you remember those 50 soldiers that the captains of 50 that had to arrest Elijah. Now, that'd be a tall order Even if you get 50 soldiers, if you're told, go arrest Elijah the prophet, you find this, by the way, in the first chapters of 2 Kings. It tells us that Amaziah, the king, he fell and he hurt himself. And he knew that he was sick, but he didn't know if he was going to die. And so what he did is he said, send a prophet to Baal-zebub, the god of Ekron, and inquire and find out if I'm going to get better. Well, his messengers were going to talk to Baal-zebub, the god of Ekron, and Elijah the prophet stopped them and said, is there no god in Israel that you're inquiring of Baal-zebub, the god of Ekron, to find out if you're getting better or not? He says, you go back and you tell King Ahaziah, no, you're not going to get better. Because you've turned to the pagans, you're going to die. And then Elijah walks away. Now, the messengers thought, well, no sense going to the god of Ekron. We better go back and tell him what we said. I told the king that. He said, what did he look like? I said, well, he was a long hair, a beard, wearing a hairy garment, leather belt. That's Elijah the Tishbite. Do you know where he is? Well, last time we saw him, he was kind of up on a hill, not too far from here. Take 50 soldiers, go arrest him and bring him to me. So these 50 soldiers, now, keep in mind, Elijah prays it doesn't rain for 3.5 years. He then prays and fire comes down from heaven. He then, in one day, kills 850 false prophets. It says Elijah slew them. I don't know if he had them all lined up and he held the sword. That'd get tiring. Now, you're told to go arrest this guy. Would that be a tough order? I would think. You know, and then he prays again and it rains. So it tells us that 2 Kings chapter 1, verse 9, the king and sent to him a captain of 50 with his 50 men. Might even have horses. And he went up to him, and there he was sitting on top of a hill. And he spoke to him, man of God, the king has said, come down. So Elijah answered and said to the captain of 50, if I am a man of God, then let fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50 men. And fire came down from heaven and consumed him and his 50. Well, the king is laying in his bed back at the palace. He's wondering, what's taking them so long? A messenger comes back and said, it doesn't look very good. Those 50 soldiers and their horses that you sent, all we can see is just smoldering remains. And the king, well, you know, pride, did I mention pride makes you stupid? He says, send another 50, arrest them, bring them to me. There might have been hope for him if he had repented or something, but no, he was just stubborn. So he sends another 50 soldiers with his 50 men. And he answered and said, man of God, thus says the king, come down quickly. So Elijah answered and said to him, if I'm a man of God, let fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50 men. And now for the second time, the fire of God comes down from heaven and consumed him and his 50 men. The king is waiting and waiting. He sends another messenger back. He said, see what's keeping them. He comes back. He said, well, there were 50 corpses. Now there's 100. It's smoldering. So maybe you ought to give up and try a different plan. King, spoiled, stubborn, proud. Send another 50 soldiers. Bring them to me. The story gets real interesting here. And he sent a third captain of his 50 with his 50 men. Now, by this point, word has spread through the ranks what's going on. These soldiers know that everybody that goes to arrest Elijah gets barbecued. And, I mean, who wants that? So, he takes a little different approach. He's a little more humble. The third captain of 50 went up and he came and he fell on his knees before Elijah. And he pleaded with him. And he said, man of God, please let my life and the life of these 50 servants of yours be precious in your sight. Look, fire has come down from heaven and burnt up the first two captains. Someone might have said, oh, it's just lightning. It's coincidence. Lightning does strike twice. And it didn't just burn one guy, it burnt 50. Yeah, it happened twice. By this point, it's pretty clear that this was a divine retribution. Let my life now be precious in your sight. And the angel of the Lord said to Elijah, go down with him. Do not be afraid of him. So he arose and he went with the king. Can you imagine how difficult it would have been to be that captain of the third 50 when the king says, go and arrest him? And as you very slowly approach the hill where Elijah's up there sitting down, see the smoldering bodies of everyone who came before you, wouldn't you want to go AWOL right about then? And say, look, I'm going to defect to the Southern Empire. I'm not going to stay with the king of Israel anymore. I mean, wouldn't you, some of you think about that? I'm listening to a madman. The king is crazy. He's sick. He's not thinking clearly. We need to have him declared incompetent. Why would I kill all my soldiers? But he still approaches Elijah. He does at least humble himself and he lives through it. I heard during the first part of the Iraq war that, Saddam Hussein said it was going to be the mother of all wars. It turned into what they called the mother of all surrenders. And after Schwarzkopf bombarded the Iraqi soldiers just relentlessly for days, that some of the commanders said, if I'm going to save my men, the only way they're going to live is if I order them to surrender. And a number of the commanders ordered their men to surrender, and they surrendered in mass, but they lived. Well, they kind of knew they were on a suicide mission also. And then you've got the story of Daniel, Daniel chapter 3. It's not of Daniel. It's actually in the book of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I don't know if you've ever thought about this before, the soldiers of Nebuchadnezzar. When Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did not bow down, the king was full of fury. This is verse 19, Daniel 3. And the expression on his face changed. This is his visage changed. It kind of means that he was so angry, he just contorted his face with fury towards Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And he spoke and he commanded that they heat the furnace 7 times more than it is usually heated. Any of you ever build a big brush fire? Up in Kovala, we frequently burn brush. And we've got some pretty good fires going. We got one fire that was seen about 10 miles away, probably farther than that. We'd just been stacking up firewood debris, and I got a dozer up there, and you can get a pretty big pile of dead wood out of the woods with a dozer in it. We had a thing that was taller than the house. And it was fairly damp out, and so I said, let's see if we can go start that brush fire and clean it up. And when it finally took off and got going, you could get a suntan from that thing about 50 feet away. And you can hear it. It sucks the air in from the ground, and it goes up the top of the fire like a chimney, and you just hear this roar, this constant whoosh. You can see leaves and dust being sucked around your feet. And when you run up and you throw another stick in there, if you don't measure carefully how close you run up to the fire, some logs are bigger. You throw it lands at the base of the fire. You got to make sure and get it in the fire. You run up too close in your enthusiasm to get the log in the fire, you lose your eyebrows. And even know what I'm talking about? Well, Nebuchadnezzar, this is a king, he commands this furnace to be heated up 7 times hotter than it was designed to handle. And everyone around can hear this thing. I mean, it's made for smelting gold. It was a furnace, they had just made this golden image. It was a furnace made for melting metal, not a bread oven. And they get this thing 7 times hotter than it's supposed to be heated. And it's just roaring. There's just like a rocket engine coming out of the top of that thing. No smoke because it's so superheated. It's just flame. And these guys have been shoveling the coal on or whatever it was that they used. And they got so hot they had to get away. Now the king says, tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Tie them securely. And I need 6 volunteers to throw them in. And I want them to be the mightiest men in my army. It just wasn't anybody. He got his crack troops. It says he commanded the furnace 7 times hotter, and he commanded certain mighty men of valor who were in his army to bind them. So 2 apiece. Take one by his shoulder, the other by his ankle. I want you to run up and heave them off in the middle. I don't want them to drop by the furnace. I want them in the furnace. I want them gone. This will teach everyone a lesson. So those first 2, they get them all tied up, and maybe it was Shadrach first. Let's just assume that his name comes first. And they get a hold of the ropes, and they look at each other, the 2 soldiers, And they say, let's go. And they charge up towards the mouth and they hurl. They've got to obey the king's order. They can feel the heat wafting towards them. And they throw Shadrach off. Their main job was to make sure he made it into the furnace. Didn't matter how hot they felt. I mean, instinctively, you get a little too close to fire, you drop them and run. But it doesn't say any of the soldiers failed in their mission. They got all the way up to the mouth. They probably were smoking by the time they let go. You know, I read a story when I was a kid I never forgot about Mickey Mantle. Anyone remember Mickey Mantle? Where when he was a boy, he was asked to go feed the cows in the barn, and they had kerosene lamps, and the barn was full of hay, and there's hay all over the ground, and without thinking one time, after throwing the hay to the cows, he was a boy, he went and he grabbed the kerosene lamp by the glass. And he picked it up. By the time he felt the searing in his hand, he knew if he dropped it, the barn would be caught, immediately go up in flames. He held on to it and had to walk over and set it back down again. He said it was the hardest thing in the world. Of course, he badly blistered his hand. He had that the rest of his life on his hand. Of course, he became a famous baseball player, catching and throwing with that hand. But he wanted to let go, but he didn't, because he knew what the consequences would be. So the second team of soldiers, they pick up Meshach. Babylonian name, or Hebrew name, was Mishael. And they look at each other. Now they can see the carcasses of the other soldiers that threw Shadrach in the fire, there by the mouth, smoldering. They're dead. Would you want to obey that order? And the king is there and everyone's watching. And they pick him up and they obey. And they die. How'd you like to be the third team? I mean, the first team might have thought, maybe if we're a little more quick with our feet and nimble with our fingers, we can just throw them a little farther. But now you get the second group. Soldiers are dead. And you got to be the third group. And you've got to take up Abednego, Azariah. You know what I'm trying to impress you with all these stories? Here you've got soldiers of ungodly kings that are willing to die rather than disobey in a bad cause, and they obey. How much more consecrated should Christians be? You know, Amazing Facts is getting ready this year. We're going to be doing some work among the Muslims, working with Islamic people. We're going to Jakarta, Indonesia, which is the largest Muslim city in the world. Going to Dubai, where technically you're not allowed to proselytize or do evangelism. And so I've been reading and studying a little bit about Islam, trying to understand it, reading some of the Quran. And I'd done a little bit before, but I'm spending a little more time now. I want to understand it. And, you know, there's a lot of people that get involved in jihad. You see, there's not as much security in the Islamic religion about the grace of the Lord and almost no assurance of salvation, because God for them is very fatalistic. And even in the judgment, because whatever Allah does, Allah wants. If he's having a bad day, he may not let you in, no matter how many alms you've given, no matter how many good deeds you've done. It doesn't really have the security that a Christian can have. But there is one way to get around that. If you want to be guaranteed eternal life, if you die a martyr, then you are a shoo-in for heaven. And so you can understand the mindset. Sometimes I think it would be easier for us as Christians to say, if I knew I could obey a difficult order, I'll die, but I'll be saved. And you die, and you're saved. As opposed to, I mean, you know, someone, if you right now were given the opportunity, you've got to jump in front of a train to save a baby who's stuck on the tracks. You're going to die, but you'll have everlasting life. Would you do it? A train wrecks pretty quick, you know. Boy, for me, I'd praise the Lord. That'd be the easy way to go. It's much harder to live as a Christian. And so for some of these, and there's a lot of very dear Islamic people, but I think everyone agrees there are some Islamic terrorists out there. Some of them are motivated not only by the desire that they're going to have everlasting life, but I don't know where they came up with the doctrine. I've not found it in the Quran yet, that if they die in some martyr's death, they also get 27 virgins or something. I don't know what the number is. It's something. How many of you have heard that before? I heard one story about this Islamic terrorist that blew himself up on some jihadist mission. And when he came to, he was surrounded by George Washington and John Adams and Thomas Jefferson and all these founding fathers that were hitting him with canes and kicking him. And he's getting all bruised and beaten, and he sees Gabriel off there, and he says, "I don't understand, Gabriel, what happened? I was promised I would have 27 virgins. What's going on?" He said, "No, that was a mistranslation. It was 27 Virginians." So I thought, since they're not taping this service, I could get away with that here. But, you know, you have to say something about the dedication, that they're willing to die. Some commentator got into hot water after 9/11 because the politicians were saying these were cowards. Some guy got up and he said, "No, they're not cowards. They're willing to die for what they believe." And it's a different kind of cowardice, I would say. Are we willing to die for what we believe? You know, if you join the military, I looked it up. You sign a contract. If you're going to enlist in the military, whether it's a Marine, Air Force, Navy, Army. And there's a whole list of things. You know what it says first, number one, in the enlistment contract, you are required to obey all lawful orders and perform all assigned duties. That's number one out of about 20 things. And by the way, civilian law and military law are different. And then before you sign your name, here's what it says. I put your name in. Here's the covenant that you sign. Do solemnly swear and affirm that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. You make a covenant as a soldier that you will lay down your life in the defense of a document. Do you believe the Word of God so much that you will die for its principles? You look and you see examples all around the world and in history of soldiers that were so sacrificial they would die for what they believe. Should Christians have less or more dedication? Soldiers all around the world that will die in unjust causes in dumb wars, following lunatics. Are we willing to obey our commander? Oh, second part of that oath, I didn't read it all to you. That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same. That I will obey the orders of the President of the United States and the orders of the officers appointed over me according to the regulations of the Uniform Code and military justice. And it says in the contract for every soldier, so help me God. That's interesting they would put in there, so help me God. Because can you obey all that and lay your life down without the help of God? Can we? You know, I heard something this week. I'll close with this. Regarding the Battle of the Alamo, I think everyone here knows the story of the Alamo. You had General Santa Anna with, started out with 1,000, ended up with 4,000 or 5,000 Mexican soldiers during the battle over the state of Texas, which was part of what Mexico or Spain was claiming as their territory. And there was only about 200, started with 100, it finally got some volunteers, about 248 to 250 Texans. Well, they weren't all Texans because you had Davy Crockett was in there and a few others, but they were trying to defend this post why the Americans could muster an army to save the territory. Final letter that made it out through a messenger was from General Travis. He and David Bowie were the commanders, and this is what he said. "Dear fellow citizens and compatriots, I am besieged by 1,000 or more of the Mexicans under Santa Anna. I sustained a continual bombardment and cannonade for 24 hours and have not lost a man. The enemy has demanded a surrender at discretion. Otherwise, the garrison are to be put to the sword if the fort is taken. I've answered the demand with a cannon shot." Their demand that they surrender, he answered by firing a cannon back. "And our flag still waves proudly from the walls. I shall never surrender or retreat. Then I call on you in the name of liberty and patriotism and everything dear to the American character to come to our aid with all dispatch. The enemy is receiving reinforcements daily and will no doubt increase to 3,000 or 4,000 in 4 or 5 days. It was finally 13 days later they launched the attack. If this call is neglected, I am determined to sustain myself as long as possible and die like a soldier who never forgets what is due to his own honor and that of his country, victory or death. And then it's signed Lieutenant Commander William Barrett Travis. So 250 Texans were killed. It's estimated they killed 600 Mexicans during the battle, and none of them were taken as prisoners of war. All of them were executed. And you probably heard the story where what Travis did when they were in the Alamo, and they knew that it was a suicide mission, he followed, Pizarro, who drew a line in the sand, that's where you get with his sword. And Pizarro, he said, that way is wealth and fame and glory and riches, that way is Spain. Well, what Travis did is he drew a line in the sand there in the Alamo court, and he stepped over the line. He said, I'm going to stay and fight and die. Said, any of you are free to escape now if you want to. And all but one stepped over the line with him. And you know, I wonder if we ever think as Christians, how dedicated are we to our commitment when we were baptized, when we accepted Jesus? Was it just because of what we're going to get out of it? Or was it because we were really thinking about the bigger mission, His glory, and the cause of Christ and the kingdom of God? And we said, Lord, I'm willing to do your will regardless of what happens to me. We know what our end will be, and we don't have anything to fear, do we? And it requires a commitment. I want to be that kind of soldier, don't you? So as we close our service today, if you would like to say with me, Lord, by your grace, so help us God, I want to be a faithful soldier. I'm willing to take up my cross and be crucified with Christ and go wherever you lead because I can trust my commander. Even if he orders me into what seems like a suicide mission, I'm willing to obey. I'm willing to do his will. Is that your desire? Why don't we turn to our closing hymn, and you can stand with me as we sing 303, and then we'll have prayer, Beneath the Cross of Jesus.